Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and with me is Brendan Layla. He's a senior executive with Ernst & Young in Cambodia and has been around the region and worked for many, many corporates for many, many years. Brendan, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Luke. Good to be with you and look forward to the conversation.
Let's go back 20 years in a broad sweep. How has things changed? I mean, it's quite remarkable when you look at from tax laws to corporate investment in countries like Cambodia and even Myanmar, I guess. How have things changed, and is life easier or has it been made more difficult?
It's a good question. There's a couple of responses. First of all, certainly in Cambodia, seen a big development in the tax and regulatory regime, certainly in the last 5 to 7 years, where the authorities have started to introduce new legislation and also update existing legislation. So historically, Cambodia's tax system was based on the French system, which was rather outdated, and so it was seen as a disincentive to foreign investment, mainly because of the lack of clarity in the laws. Another area of big development that I've seen over the last 5 or 6 years is the introduction of double tax agreements. So prior to 2016, Cambodia did not have a single double tax agreement with any other country. Put that in perspective, Even North Korea had a few double tax agreements. And, you know, double tax agreements are obviously designed to prevent the double taxation of the same income in different countries, and hence to provide certainty on the treatment of income between the source and resident country. So again, a double tax agreement is central to providing more certainty to potential foreign investors looking to consider investing in Cambodia. Prior to Cambodia, I was in Vietnam. We've also seen their international tax laws developing quite nicely, and again, with the objective on the one hand, secure the revenue base, the tax base, to prevent leakage in the form of shifting profits out of the country, but also to provide more certainty and create a more investor-friendly environment.
It's quite a subjective question, but are the tax laws being imposed fairly?
I think they are. I think probably what a lot of people don't realize is the enormity of the task at hand. And I'm talking about the Revenue Authority, the General Department of Taxation, or GDT, as it's commonly referred to here in Cambodia. The enormity of the task at hand to get, first of all, the laws up to date, so that we've got a modern framework and taxation system. B, to upskill their employees, which is, again, another big task and not something that can be solved overnight or even, in a few years. That's a job that can take many, many years to get your auditors up to a good standard where they can apply the law fairly and also have the technical capabilities. To create a bit of context here, you know, Cambodia didn't really have a formal tax system prior to 2014. So what they did was they relied on the withholding tax mechanism almost exclusively for the collection of taxes, whereby you as the payer, say renting an apartment or renting commercial property to run your business, you were required to withhold tax on your rental payment. We had, VAT was another big area of leakage where hardly any VAT was collected. And essentially, it was, you know, the tax regime was referred to as an estimated regime insofar as the revenue estimated your tax liability, which is obviously not fair. It's to you, the taxpayer. You know, if you feel that the revenue authority is overestimating what you owe. So the whole idea around all these changes and to modernize the system is to bring more people and businesses within the tax net. And as I mentioned, you know, to provide more clarity with through the updating introduction of new laws. So while it's maybe appear to some people that they're not applying the law fairly, there are a lot of factors that are making that perhaps more challenging. But, you know, with time, I think we are starting to see a more fairer, consistent application of the laws and rules.
Right. Where do most people or companies, how do they find themselves in trouble? Where do they get into trouble?
That's another good question. And there are a number of areas where companies are perhaps, historically maybe have not been aware of the law or how it's applied. traditional area, well, a traditional problem really was withholding tax on rent of property. And that was because in addition to the withholding tax, the lessor is required to charge you, the lessee, VAT at 10%. And so many people, and understandably so, felt that their liability to tax regarding the rental of property had been discharged on the payment of VAT, not realizing that withholding tax also applied. So, you know, that's an area that where we've seen a lot of companies coming unstuck, and you know, typically that will go back many years. And so if they do an audit and an assessment is raised, there's also penalties and interest. So that can lead to a fairly substantial adjustment. Other areas where taxpayers have perhaps slipped up or you know, are experiencing problems is in regard to offshore payments for services rendered by a non-resident. So a minute ago I mentioned that, you know, historically the tax mm-hmm. system was based on the withholding tax mechanism. So if services were rendered by a non-resident for the benefit of a beneficiary in Cambodia, payment for those services you know, leaving Cambodia were subject to and still are subject to withholding tax. Historically, perhaps companies weren't aware of that requirement, and so they were, with the increasing level of audits, they've been picked up there as well. VAT, another area that the law has been strengthened in terms of what VAT applies to and what it doesn't, and so that's creating more consistency, but historically a lot of problems around VAT as well.
And the enforcement of these laws has been controversial, I understand, in that the tax department in Cambodia has been active in recruiting inspectors who have worked for big accounting firms, and that's created some sorts of issues in terms of conflicts of issues, I guess.
Yes, so I can't comment personally on that, but certainly there's an awareness in the taxpaying and accounting community in Cambodia that the GDT actively looks to recruit staff or employees of accounting and law firms to bridge the gap, or, you know, to improve their skill set. But and just in terms of a headcount, you know, since the laws were more formally applied from 2014 onwards, there's been they've experienced a huge shortage in the number of auditors to perform the work. So there's two components to that. And yes, I guess that it could be seen as perhaps, if not controversial, but maybe frowned upon or eyebrows raised in the business community mm-hmm. insofar as people that are being recruited from law firms and accounting firms and the like are taking the knowledge, perhaps client knowledge with them.
Inside knowledge, I would have thought.
Yeah, to the revenue and, you know, the questions around whether they would then seek to initiate an audit on a company that has previously been a client of theirs. I think it's reasonably well known as well that the auditors do get financial incentives
and commissions.
For raising assessments. So that it does, you know, potentially introduce certain challenges. But again, you know, this sort of thing, and in terms of getting bonuses and incentives and commissions, that doesn't typically take place in a developed country because, you know, that wouldn't be allowed under the laws. But here, you know, we obviously operate in a different environment, a less developed environment. You know, I've spoken about the lack of technical knowledge. And so, you know, it's something that we have to accept. It happens. But, you know, to balance that out, certainly from what I've seen with audits, there's certainly a more formalized process for appealing against decisions. There is certainly processes in place where taxpayers certainly have the opportunity to present their case as it gets escalated up through the organisation.
Is that more like an appeals process? Is that expensive?
So just to clarify, let's say an audit is initiated by an auditor and the taxpayer objects. Typically, they have a number of opportunities to submit. To first of all, submit written submissions stating their case and objecting to the proposed assessment. There's also the opportunity to have meetings with the auditors to explain their case. And so that process, you know, it takes its course until a final decision is made by the auditor, and then it goes up to the directors of the GDT for their decision, and then again there's further processes allowing the taxpayer to object and appeal. If that is unsuccessful, then yes, the next step is an appeal, a more formal legal appeal process. Cambodia does have the framework and the mechanism for that. However, to date, I think there may only have been one or two cases that are or have been before the appeals tribunal, which I understand is headed up by, you know, a judicial officer, perhaps a judge. But as I say, it's not really been taken, been used at this stage. So we don't have any precedent, if you like.
That's what I was going to ask next, actually. Yeah. The lack of precedence in this country is, it's not about fault or blame. It's just one of the investment realities, I guess.
Yeah, so it's the environment that we have to operate on or in. You know, if I compare Cambodia to Australia, where I started my tax career with the Australian Tax Office, there is a lot of precedent around tax law in Australia, and that's come from court cases covering a multitude of taxation issues, and the classic one being the distinction between capital and revenue, for example. And so, you know, going back almost 100 years, there have been many court cases throughout in Australian history that have provided clarity on these sorts of issues. So, you know, we're at a stage in countries like Australia where those types of issues have been dealt with over many decades, and the certainty's there. So, you know, the hope is that Cambodia will also go down that path, insofar as there will be formal and well-recognized court processes to then start this process of precedents being, you know, emerging, and then from the precedent, more clarity develops around more contentious areas of taxation and the law.
We're in the era of COVID-19, obviously. How has that impacted on your industry and foreign investment in Cambodia and more broadly around the region?
Another good question, because there are multiple answers to that. So on dealing with the challenges of COVID-19, we've obviously seen a reduction to a certain degree of activity in the traditional industries in Cambodia. And so I'm referring to manufacturing, particularly garments, footwear, backpacks and other consumer goods like that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were seeing articles in international press where, for example, garment manufacturers were manufacturing products for the brand owners who are obviously headquartered in other parts of the world. And under the contracts or clauses in the contracts around the manufacture of these products, the brand owner could actually refuse to take the orders once they'd been processed. So
right.
We had a situation where warehouses were being filled up with finished products, but they couldn't ship. So that's in terms of an international investment and a destination, and one of the impacts of COVID-19.
Right.
More recently, I think that we're getting some movement there and the situation's improving. Obviously, Cambodia's other big economic driver is tourism, and that's been decimated.
Sure, it's collapsed.
Yeah, and we're not unique in that situation. There's most other countries in the region. Thailand, I know, has suffered badly. And so, you know, the GDT, I think they should be applauded for the measures they've taken to provide incentives and particularly relief to targeted industries such as garment, tourism, international travel industries, where they've provided relief in terms of relaxation of payment of certain taxes, consumption type taxes, hotel accommodation type taxes. So that's you know, need to be applauded. But again, you know, they don't have the revenue resources of bigger countries where they can provide more wide scale blanket concessions or incentives. But if I move on to a positive spin off or side effect of COVID-19. The key, in my view, outcome of COVID-19 is that many large multinational organizations have traditionally had their manufacturing base in China have come to realize that an event like COVID-19, and perhaps there will be further events in the future like that, where you have the majority or maybe nearly all your manufacturing in one location or jurisdiction, you are obviously far more vulnerable to another event like COVID-19. So the upshot or the outcome of that is that many multinationals are now looking to broaden their manufacturing footprint across the region. And so certainly we've seen multinationals making inquiries and some even following through with the, relocating parts of their manufacturing base or footprint to countries like Cambodia. So that is certainly a positive outcome of Cambodia, and I think that we will see a lot more of that going forward.
Right. It's an interesting concept in the sense that for decades we were taking garments as an example. For decades we were seeing manufacturers playing one country off against another. The countries are poor: Bangladesh, Cambodia, India, Myanmar, and there seemed to be this constant game on where you're challenging the unions, challenging the government, and grinding down wages. It's like, well, they'll, you know, they can do this for $20 a day less, we'll go to that country. And it's sort of backfired in the world of COVID-19.
It has a bit, you know, and but I also think that the reality now is that because of the size of industry, particularly garments, and because of supply chain disruptions, what we've seen is that most of your big brand Western garments and other consumable goods brands are, well, they do, and they have had for a number of years now, manufacturing presence, a manufacturing presence in a number of the countries, like you mentioned. Bangladesh is one good example,
right.
Cambodia, Vietnam, and other lower income or lower wage jurisdictions. And so I think, you know, one of the main opportunity for Cambodia is geographic, in the sense
right.
It is right between, well, first of all, it's in the center of the Southeast Asian region, but it's between Thailand, which is obviously far more developed, and then Vietnam, which is more developed than Cambodia. But the opportunity there is to take advantage of its location to create supply chain routes to its benefit. If I can expand on that for a moment. So what we've seen, so we have a number of Japanese clients that traditionally have had large manufacturing presence in Thailand, and the main industry there is auto manufacturing. So historically, you know, Japanese, the big Japanese auto manufacturers have had a manufacturing base in Thailand for decades now. But with on the back of Thailand's increasing prosperity, economic development, is obviously rising wages of factory workers, etc., to the point where your more menial or labor-intensive tasks have become too expensive in Thailand. And so what we're seeing, and it's certainly, I believe, one of the main success stories over recent years, is the relocation of, as I mentioned, the more labor-intensive functions to Cambodia, and particularly if you look at the Poy Phet area, which is just over the border from Thailand, is a very sizable Japanese presence there now. And not only auto parts, but that's been expanded now into electronic component manufacturing and assembly.
Right, so by that, the impression I'm getting is, I remember Poy Phet when it was nothing more than a bamboo pole and a border crossing. The impression I'm getting from what you're saying is that the Thais are investing heavily just across the border so they can bring their goods back in at a cheaper rate.
Exactly. But it's more the actual Japanese, what we call a original equipment manufacturer, OEM. So think of any auto brand or whatever. So it's the Japanese parents deciding, right, we need to set up a labor-intensive operation in Cambodia, and they'll make parts or components that will go into the assembly of the finished product in Thailand.
Right.
So as I say, huge success story. And you know, the other point, talking from a socio-economic point of view, obviously, you know, if you look at garment manufacturing, the skill set is not very advanced, but also more to the point, there's limited opportunity to increase your skill set if you are on a production run, sewing, you know, garments together all day long. Whereas if you look at these Japanese OEM manufacturers, they are making far more complex products in Cambodia that need more complex machinery to operate. And so there's a massive learning opportunity and upskilling opportunity that these new industries are creating. So that is, there's a lot of potential there for these nascent industries to expand and create a far better skill set amongst Cambodian workers.
Okay. If you had $1 million to invest, or even $100,000 or $500,000, we're living in an imaginary world perhaps, but where would you put it?
Good question.
People are saying gold has gone through the roof. People are saying it's now too expensive. Stock markets are all over the place.
Yeah.
COVID-19 is pulling the rug out from the economies around the world.
Yeah. I guess it's obviously we're living in challenging times. You're right. Gold is, I think it's now historically at its highest level ever. Traditionally, gold seen as a store of value in turbulent times, also as a store of value against inflation. But you know, we're probably more in a deflationary environment. But COVID's created massive opportunities in two areas in particular. Obviously, in your biotechs, so your pharmaceutical companies,
mm-hmm.
and then all the supporting industries around pharma and biotech, it's clear that there's a lot of opportunity there for investment in not only new products and new pharmaceuticals to deal with diseases like COVID, but there's going to be a lot more diseases like that coming our way, I'm sure. Obviously, on the product side, we're seeing people making hand sanitizers and masks, and there's a huge shortage of them. So that's one area where, if you were someone looking to invest money in a business or on a stock exchange, that would be a key area. I mentioned supply chain as well. There's going to be a lot of opportunity as companies look to reconfigure their supply chains and companies in that industry. But the other big one is obviously telecommunications and IT and what have you. And I'm specifically referring to things like Zoom and other products like that, where people are now finding out they don't need to go in and sit down face to face in a meeting room. They can have meetings with people around the world on Zoom. And again, the technology is fairly new. It's been around for a while, but my thinking is that the technology is going to increase by a factor of, and in a couple of years' time, it'll be seriously impressive technology out there, and it'll simply remove the need for people to meet in person.
Travel.
Yeah, exactly. We're seeing people are now in countries like Australia spending more money on their houses and doing their houses up.
Home offices and...
Yeah. I was reading just yesterday, the day before, that the demand for swimming pools in Oz has gone through the roof. And the reason for that is because people are maybe starting to realize, look, I don't need to get on a plane and go to Bali or wherever every, couple of months.
Right.
Let's stay at home and enjoy our home. So that's...
I think it's going to be one of the big issues that comes out of the whole COVID-19 pandemic is that a lot of people are happy to be at home. A lot of people have happy families. I understand the concerns about being locked down and domestic violence and all the issues that go along with that. But a lot of people, they've broken the habit of going to the office, the ritual of commuting.
Yeah.
Everything that goes with that is kind of, why should we? And if people are getting by on less but living more happily from home, that's going to change the way that will change the nature in how we do business, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. And, already some fairly large multinationals are saying to their employees, look, if you would like to work at home permanently, that's fine. You'd be welcome to do that. And obviously, advances in technology is going to allow that and be conducive to that. And then it's up to you to manage your family and home responsibilities with your work commitments. But, I'm sure we'll figure that out in time. But, massive socio-economic change, I think, on the horizon.
One wonders what that will do to rent investments in the big glitzy skyscrapers where all these corporates are housed. They won't need them the way they used to.
Exactly, and maybe the same could be said for hotels. Where every city in the world seems to feel the need to have all the major brands. We're seeing it at the moment. Cambodia is getting a bunch of new hotels with famous brand names on there. On the exterior,
Hilton.
So it's they may struggle. They may find that they'll struggle to fill the rooms or get the occupancy rate they need to
right.
get a return on their investment.
And would that make an industry consolidation inevitable?
It would do, but I think what it could also do is change the industry fundamentally, where there could well be a move away from, as you were saying, a big skyscraper, mm-hmm. you know, with a 1,000-room hotel in it, to maybe smaller boutique type hotels, and they don't necessarily only have to be boutique, but you could have a smaller hotel catering for business travellers,
right.
where your costs are far more manageable. And maybe you only need, 20 or 50 people a night, business travellers, holiday mm-hmm. travellers, to meet your overhead. So, yeah, we could see a fundamental shift in that industry in that sense, where there's no longer a need for a massive building with 1,000 rooms in it or whatever. I mean, I'll just mention it.
Yep.
The two new booming success stories in terms of manufacturing in Cambodia. And really, they fly under the radar and haven't received much attention at all. And one is the bicycle manufacturing and assembly industry.
Right.
And the other is the mattress manufacturing industry. I was looking at some figures the other day. In the first few months of the year, Cambodia exported bicycles to Europe to the value of a few hundred million dollars.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Well, I didn't either. It was only from reading the local newspaper. And I think maybe the reason that it flies under the radar is it's not the brand owner is not here doing the manufacturing or assembly. They are engaging third parties. So exactly the same way as your garment manufacturer.
Okay.
Nike, Adidas, they don't have a manufacturing presence here. They engage third parties.
Basically outsourced.
Yeah. And that's clearly what's happening here with these two industries, bicycle and mattress. And so that perhaps explains why
right.
they've been flying under the radar. But massively successful and long may it last.
Okay. It's getting harder to sort of crystal ball gaze about the future. But where do you see yourself and how do you see the economies going over the next 6 to 12 months? Obviously, COVID's going to have a big impact, particularly when you look at what's happening, say, in Australia in the middle of winter and how things are going in Europe and the United States. Winter in the Northern Hemisphere could be devastating. Still a few months away. But if you had to make a pronouncement over the next 1 or 2 years, what would it be?
Well, if I make a pronouncement, I guess at a global level, I think no one knows the timing of when we're going to get out of this, but you know, if it's at some point next year, early mid next year, I think economic activity will pick up fairly quickly. But we are, I think, going to see a fundamental shift in the basis of many economies, particularly in the developed world. Looking at it from a Southeast Asian perspective, I think it's presented massive opportunities. As I was talking earlier about supply chain management, setting up supply chains across the region. We're still a very competitive region in terms of manufacturing. So I think there will be a lot of opportunity there. Cambodia is holding up pretty well economically, but I guess the next 6 to 12 months are going to be crucial as to, you know, how we come out of this.
Brendan Layla, thank you very much.
Pleasure, Luke, and it was a good conversation. Thank you.
Cheers.